Okay, well, shall we start? It will take a while to sort of get going, so if those of you who arrive a little bit late, it probably won't be a disaster. Can I say hello and welcome to the LSE, virtually at least, for tonight's event? The event is called Project Europe: Success or Failure, and we'll be focusing on the important new book by Professor Kiran Patel, which has recently been published by CUP. What we're planning to do is Professor Patel will be presenting the work, and then a number of us will be commenting on it. But I wanted to start things off by saying welcome to all of you. Apologies for the fact that we can't be hosting you in person in London. It'd be lovely to be in some LSE lecture theatre with all of you physically present. But we are turning this bizarre new world of Zoom meetings to our advantage insofar as we're actually scattered all over the place. So Professor Patel will be joining us from Munich. Dr. Karamouzi is joining us from Greece. Professor Nolan is in Brooklyn, and I'm in London. And I suspect that the audience too is scattered all over the place. So there are pluses to this bizarre new situation in which we find ourselves. Can I say a couple of things about the event? First of all, it's sponsored or co-sponsored by the International History Department at the LSE and by Cambridge University Press, who published the volume. And I should say a particular word of thanks to Alice Bryant in our department, in the International History Department, and to Chris Burrows at CUP for their help in organizing the logistics of this evening's talk. Can I also briefly say that the event is being recorded so that if you intervene in the Q&A later, sort of via the microphone rather than via the chat, your question will be recorded. So be aware that that is happening. But I will now pass over without much further ado to Professor Nolan, who is the kind of real chair of this event. We have to have an LSE chair because it's an LSE event, but I'm actually meant to be acting as discussant rather than chair. So I will hand over to Mary and she will take control of the situation. Mary.
Okay, thank you very much. I'm sorry we can't all be gathering in London like many of you. I'm suffering from acute cabin fever. There are worse places to be stuck than New York City. Nonetheless, I would really like to be able to get out, which doesn't look like it's going to happen until sometime in the spring. So we will make the best of our ability to meet on Zoom. We have three very wonderful people here today to talk about Kiran Patel's new book. It's a book which was actually published in German a couple of years ago and is now translated into English, and it is that translation and publication by Cambridge University Press that we're celebrating. He is professor and chair of European history at Ludwig Maximilian University in Munich and is an extremely prolific author. His most important books are Soldiers of Labor, Labor Service in Nazi Germany and New Deal America, and The New Deal: A Global History. The discussants are two experts on the history of the EC/EU, the European integration, the European project. As Kiran makes clear in his books, these terms have overlapping but distinctive, frequently changing meanings. On the EU and EC, most recently Roy Jenkins in the European Commission presidency, 1976 to 1980. And from your website, I understand you're working on a longer project on the complicated and often unhappy history of the UK and Europe. Dr. Irini Karamouzi is a senior lecturer in contemporary history at the University of Sheffield, and she is the author of Greece, the EEC, and the Cold War, 1974 to 1979. So we're going to kick this off with Kiran giving a sort of preview overview of what is really a remarkably interesting and provocative book, The European Project. Kiran.
Thank you very much, Molly, and thank you also to LSE, to Cambridge Universitas, to Alice, to Piers, to Irene, and to you, Molly, again, for setting this up and making time to discuss the book tonight. Again, I'm very happy about this, though I'm also sad that we can't be in London altogether. I only want to speak for some 5 minutes so that we have enough time to discuss the project and also bigger issues around it. So this book basically is a book that tries to do something slightly different than what we have done in the history of the European integration process for most of its 4 decades of historical research. So far, I would argue most of the research has been very much busy analyzing the motives, the negotiation results and treaties and so on in the history of European integration, whereas my book tries to do something which I felt has really not caught a lot of attention so far. And that is going beyond the politics of European integration and really look into the effects of what European integration really meant for people, for citizens and also people beyond the member states, over particularly the 4 decades of the Cold War. So this is the period that the book covers. And in the book, each of the chapters that I have, 8 in total, basically for this whole period of the Cold War discusses one of the, I find, key questions. Questions such as, did European integration really contribute to peace? How about its contribution to raising prosperity? And was or is it really a community of values, some would argue, and how also about its democratic deficit? So what you have is a collection of big questions, and again, the attempt at least is to arrive at succinct answers to these as to the effects of European integration for the lives of Europeans and others during this formative period of European integration. So I presume I still got some 2 minutes, so I can't summarize all my findings, but let me just take one of the examples that I'm working with here. The peace question is probably the most important one for the history of European integration, also to legitimize these efforts to build a supranational entity of this kind. Now you have 2 narratives, one possibly best summarized by the Peace Nobel Prize committee decision of 2012 to award this prize to the European Union, which again argues that the EU has been fundamentally important in this context, whereas, for instance, actors such as Boris Johnson have always argued that the EU is completely unimportant and that other forums, particularly NATO, were really the key actors at the international level in this context. Now, my argument on some 40 pages of the book is too long to summarize here fully, but I would want to argue that the EC actually was, as predecessor to today's European Union, important in creating peace, but later and in different forms than we tend to think. So this is less an argument about peace in the context of the Cold War, in the context of military confrontation and conflict, but rather one that focuses on the social dimension of peace, particularly the question of also social redistribution in the context of specific policy programs such as agriculture policy, but also through even softer factors such as creating a culture of compromise and of also working together, that I also see as an important factor that contributed to social peace over this period. And if I, from there already, go on to one of the other arguments, prosperity, I would also argue there that it's interesting, firstly, that we know surprisingly little as to on the effects of European integration in this regard. But also here, the history has an interesting answer for us, that basically, yes, integration contributed to prosperity, but also more during a period than we tend to ignore, the second half of the Cold War, the period that is often seen as a crisis period of European integration, where relatively at least the contribution of European integration, from all I could see, was larger than in the period before. Instead of running you through other arguments of the book, I would like to summarize my book's approach and findings in 3 points already. Firstly, and I'm speaking here particularly to the historians and also social scientists working in the field, the book tries to make an effort to put distance between the narratives that the institutions themselves have left for us, and that often also provide formative dimensions of narratives that we as scholars tend to write, and assess the process of European integration with fresh eyes. Secondly, maybe more at the empirical level, I found it myself surprising that if I assess these various dimensions that I mentioned, very often the 1970s turn out to be a real turning point, after which only the European community started to matter an awful lot and really turned out to become a different creature than other international organizations, such as the OECD, for instance, or the Council of Europe, and really start to have a systemic impact on European matters. And lastly, maybe an answer or dimension that might be interesting For those of you who are more interested in policy dimensions, I would think that also this history book has lessons for today. Let me go back to the question of peace, where the argument is that the EU has big credentials in this dimension of social peace creation, much less of a history when it comes to military and security dimensions proper, and that this might also raise questions as to its capabilities and future trajectory from where we stand. I'll leave it there and look forward to the discussion. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you very much, Kieran. We decided rather than having people present a series of small talks, we would try to have a more interactive conversation. So let me toss out some questions to sort of help frame this conversation. To begin with, and this is directed primarily at Piers and Eleni, what were the most important ways in which this book, Project Europe, made you, who have written so much on European integration, rethink your understanding of the history of European integration, of the EC, EU? What are the most important arguments you think people should take away from this book? Piers, unmute yourself.
Okay, yes, yeah, sorry. The Zoom etiquette once more. I enjoyed the book a lot because it made me think, not necessarily because I agreed with all of it. In a sense, it's good that that Kieran and I have disagreed for many years, and there are lots of points which we could argue over. But I think what really attracted me to the book was its just very, very different approach. We have lots of books, many of them very good, that take us from the early stages of the European integration process to much more recent days and essentially trace the process as it has developed. And many of these books are out there and can be sort of very usefully read by many people. But this book doesn't do that. It does something very, very different. It takes a much more thematic approach, and it takes, as Kieran was stressing himself a moment earlier, it takes an approach which focuses on the effects. And I think by so doing, it kind of shines a light on the gaps of what we really know. Yes, the EU has now been, or the European integration process at least, has now been in existence for 70 years. We often assert and often claim that it has had a big effect on Europe's development, whether it be its political development or its economic development. And yet when we actually try and sort of measure that effect, it's frustratingly difficult to do. I think this book makes a very good stab at it, and some of Kieran's ideas are fascinating and provocative and really make you sit up and think. But in a way, the big message I got out of it was a sort of very Socratic message. It was how little we knew and how much more research we need to do in order properly to understand what this process is. Now, of course, it is true that at the moment, my own country is trying to do an interesting experiment to find out the effects of European integration by leaving the process. So perhaps the British are contributing in a distinctive way to research on this subject. But I would sort of take that kind of, what it really showed me was how little I knew, but also I think how little all of us who say we're experts on the process really understand or know. But Irini, I'll leave you leave the floor to you.
Thank you so much for the invitation, and I agree it was a lovely book to read. Even we have to do it online during the COVID times. But I think what Kieran has done, which is impressive, is, you know, writing European integration and doing it interesting for scholars and public alike is such an impressive feat, given how remotely it's technical and complicated the process of European integration comes across. And Kieran has done that by not following a chronological order, doing the kind of thematic approach, by kind of providing us what I think are the master frames of how we understand as people European integration. He takes these different themes of peace, prosperity, growth, technology, dissatisfaction. But what I think was interesting, at least as someone who has tried to write the history of European integration, is that he doesn't have, he really focuses not so much on the successes, which are many to count, but he also focuses on the failures. And I think he kind of offers us a sober reminder that actually dysfunctionality and dissatisfaction was part and parcel of this normality of European integration, we talk about it, we know the events, we know about the empty chair crisis, we know about crisis in the 70s, the 80s, and this was part of the story. It's just when you see it in such a coherent manner that you realize that today crisis is not anything new, that we should really see that as part of this process that was a making and unmaking the EEC. The second point, and my last point, just as a first comment, was that I was just last week, I heard Martin Conway's new book on the new democratic age, where he talked about this emergence of the new democratic culture that had to do about the that was highlighting the role of expertise in bringing the, in controlling this post-war settlement. And it's interesting how Kieran in his book is trying to draw the same parallels. The reason why the EEC becomes successful is because it follows the same models as other Western European countries. They are respecting and they're bringing in the expertise so as to bring in this new democratic culture. So in the way the EEC is not so much different from what is happening as a trend in Western Europe during that time. So already you see this overlapping web of interdevelopments that really explain, and Kieran does a great job on how the EEC came to happen and how incrementally it became important as a centerpiece of European cooperation.
Piers, you raised two questions that maybe you and Irene and Kieran, if you will be part of this conversation, would want to come in on. The first is, you said, you know, you found the book important, the approach really interesting. There were, of course, many things that you disagreed with. And I wondered if you wanted to talk a little bit about where your understanding diverges from his. The same with you, Irene. And then you raised a second really interesting question, which is, you said his book showed us much of what we still don't know, what the gaps are. What do you think they are? Kieran, what do you think they might be? Having finished this book, what would you still like to know more about?
Both excellent questions. Well, so Kieran and I have been discussing this kind of thing for ages, and we will probably continue to do so. And we, of course, agree on a lot. But let me pick up two points. The first is that I think I would have a slightly different take on the peace argument that that Kieran starts with. I agree with the importance that he attaches to the social peace argument. I also agree with the importance that he attaches to the 1970s as a period where I think Europe did play a stabilizing role, particularly in Southern Europe and the Mediterranean. But I'm slightly less dismissive than he is probably about the earlier period. Not that the contribution of the then fledgling institutions were the sole answer. Clearly, the overarching security umbrella provided by the Americans was equally crucial, probably more crucial, as was NATO, its embodiment, as was the way in which America's very dominance meant that the chances of any European single power being able to assert the kind of influence that Britain, France, and Germany at their various times had once done, all of that was very important as well. So I'm certainly not suggesting that integration was the sole factor here, but I would probably put a bit more emphasis than he does on the contribution, particularly at the level of reconciling Franco-German opinion to each other, and perhaps less so in the case of the Netherlands and Germany, but so that there was a huge amount of hatred and animosity, and I think that did need to be removed. I think the removal happens more at an elite level than it does at a popular level, but nevertheless, I do think in lancing that boil, the European integration process was part of a successful package of measures that worked together. So that would be one. Another thing where I perhaps slightly differ on, but this is a long-standing point that we've been batting backwards and forwards, is that I think I would put more emphasis on the sort of ambition of the institutions from the start. One of Kieran's strong arguments, and this is something he's argued before, but he develops further in this book, is the perfectly correct assertion that in the early stages of the integration process, the European structures that have gone on to evolve into today's EU were just part of a complex landscape littered with lots of other competing organisations. And that is, of course, absolutely correct. And I'm not disputing that. But I think where I would perhaps slightly differ is preamble to the European Coal and Steel Community, and then read, then talk about what the European Coal and Steel Community actually did. And there's a total mismatch. One is about peace and civilization and grandiose rhetoric, and the other is about controlling coal and steel. Ugh, boring. And this mismatch was very, but I think there my emphases are a little bit different. So I perhaps it's best if Irini comes in on this, and then we'll go back to the gaps in a moment, shall we?
Okay.
I mean, I think that one thing I was missing, I wasn't disagreeing that much, because Kieran makes a point in the introduction about this is a book that we need to understand how much more about how people think about European integration. And as historians, we do lack engagement with political scientists that actually measure that kind of public opinion attitudes towards European integration. I agree with his point that, you know, he says at the epilogue, I think, or in several other chapters when he talks about dissatisfaction, that, you know, they were tolerating, people were tolerating the European institutions. They were not really embracing them at some point. And I was really wondering, how much do we really know about that? You know, how can historiography at least can really kind of make advances in substantiating empirically these kind of claims, you know, especially when we enter, I agree, especially for the first decades, but when we enter 70s and the 1980s, we need to know better how we reach at that mastery point where political science seems to be concentrating on, and what kind of resources we use. I think we haven't been as imaginative as we should be. And I didn't see that kind of suggestion from Kieran, how can we rectify that? I felt that it was missing, because it's such a great point of how this project really, has it gone that bad for people, or it has always been that indifferent, as you have said? And that was just one thing that really came up as I was reading the book.
Can I briefly react to these points, Molly?
Sure, absolutely.
Yeah, great. Again, firstly, I should say that as any scholarly contribution, also my book very much builds on the work of others, without also the work of people present in this Zoom meeting, and also, of course, very much Piers and Irini's work, my book would not look the way it does, or would not never have been written. So in that sense, I'm deeply indebted also to, again, the work of many others, and I hope the book is also clear on that. On the peace point that Piers made, I think, again, the funny thing is that we don't really disagree. My argument is just also trying to look at slightly different levels. So again, if you talk about the ambitions of the institutions, I agree fully, and I hope that the book is also quite clear on this, also on the kind of grandstanding of some of the words of commission presidents such as Hallstein. Again, the book very much tries to look at the effects on people's lives beyond the elites. And there I would argue that also when it comes to issues such as German-French reconciliation, for instance, other factors and dimensions, such as city twinning, for instance, which for the longest history during the Cold War was not done under the umbrella or very much the institutional framework of the European communities, but done in different formats and also from civil society actors, it would therefore be wrong to subsume all these issues under the process of European integration. And again, what Piers rightly has called this imperialistic dimension is exactly what I try to also show by, again, juxtaposing the role of the EU to those of other forums, and thus by decentering, if you will, show how partial its contribution actually has been. So in that sense, I would fully agree that we should also go further in understanding and trying to analyze why on earth the European community amongst these various projects then in the end was seen as the top dog, the key project of European integration. And again, I would also agree with Irini that, again, we still need to go further in trying to understand citizens' attitudes towards the European integration process. So what I've done, just to explain to readers who haven't been able to look at the book so far, is, for instance, to look at some of these Eurobarometer statistics, but also trying to read them against the grain, because I think there we have, as always with statistics, a problematic source, because they were also created with a political purpose to also really actively support the integration process. Hence also there going to the archival documents and seeing the backside of how these statistics were created, what information was also left out, how categories of support were built, and which dimensions were muted, was one part where I felt I could contribute to the existing literature and go slightly beyond what we have already. But I would agree with Irini, as I would agree with Piers, that also looking further into these other dimensions of people's engagement with processes of European integration and institutions, also during the period of the Cold War, remains a very big task for research.
I wonder whether one of the points that help explain this sort of what I think is a collective failure on all our part properly to sort of understand opinion is linked to the point that Irini was making about sort of the way in which European integration succeeded, partly because it was going with the grain of much of European politics. Now, if you do that, and perhaps this is in a sense echoing what I was saying earlier about the peace argument, it's very difficult to work out who's doing what. Sort of, is this a Belgian policy or is this a European policy? If the two are more or less work, so if they collide head on, you can pretty clearly see which is one and which is the other. But if they're actually kind of working together and some things are being done at a supranational level and some things are being done intergovernmentally but cooperatively and other things are being done nationally, if they're all more or less heading in the same direction, it's pretty difficult for us experts to disaggregate that and work out who's doing what. No wonder that the general public, who don't have the sort of time or the sort of energy or incentive to kind of work out who's doing exactly what, little wonder that they don't understand this and therefore that they don't really understand what the effects are. So I think part of the problem here is, in a sense, this it's too much part of a kind of complex system. Yes, it's a system in itself that has grown and expanded and developed in all sorts of interesting ways, as you show, but it works together with the establishment of democratic systems within individual nation states. It works together with what you and I have both called in different places the Atlantic cocoon of American-led Cold War institutions. It works with lots of other structures, and its effectiveness lies precisely in the fact that it works with these other structures. But for that very reason, saying that this is Europe and this is NATO and this is Belgium and this is Brussels, hard to do.
Although periodically, and certainly we're at one of those moments, popular opinion at least does say, this is Europe and we don't like it, this is not. So how does one explain, you know, that kind of swing when that occurs? If, as Kieran, I read you arguing that much of the time, popular opinion was more or less not very interested, rather indifferent, but it could be mobilized, for or mostly against periodically.
So if this is a question to me, then again, the answer is basically just also echoing what you said. I've argued that again, maybe I should start differently. There is an argument in the literature, particularly by two political scientists who've been immensely influential in shaping our views on popular support in the European integration process, Lisbeth Hoche and Gary Marks, scholars from the University of Chapel Hill, North Carolina, who've argued that basically, till the Maastricht Treaty, you had a permissive consensus, and then things become much more difficult. And my argument is that already this period prior to the Maastricht Treaty, during the Cold War, saw a much more conflictuous and problematic relationship between citizens and European integration. Again, not that people were so much against it, but as you rightly said, that people were very often different, and that it was, in fact, not too difficult to mobilize people also against European integration. And if you will, and maybe just to kind of approach this argument from the perspective of ongoing discussions today, what I think we often have today is a discussion that, well, today the EU is in fundamental crisis, and its history looks ever more beautiful and bright. So people tend to think of the halcyon day when everything was easy, and only now do we have problems. So in that sense, there is also, if you will, even a normative and political argument in the book by arguing, well, things in fact have actually been much more difficult. And maybe relating also to the argument that Piers had made a second ago, I would fully agree that levels and links of causality between the history of the EU and popular support or prosperity or peace are very difficult to establish. What I want to argue is that as a field of scholars, and I would include myself in the literature so far, we've often singled out the EU too much and its predecessors, and hence established causal, at least insinuations, as if this was the key forum that then made a difference. And again, that was also because we've been very often singling out this one international institution without looking at the same time also at the whole host of other forums that were also contributing to all these efforts of creating prosperity, peace, and what have you not in Western Europe and the Western world. So in that sense, again, by adding actors to that to that play, if you will, of European integration and cooperation in post-war Europe, I at least try to complicate the story and also bring us further to arriving at answers as to the precise role of the European Union. I would not want to argue that this is the last word, as Piers rightly said. It's also trying to open a different kind of discussion than the ones that have, I think, dominated the field so far.
Can I also add something? I think what is interesting about this talk about popular opinion, what Kieran is now saying, I think what, because you make a great point about how this transformation starts in the 70s and the 80s, all these informal developments that feed in the institutional architecture that Maastricht provides. But I think what is also interesting, I'm looking at Southern Europe, Hans-Peter Krisi has written about this. You see elites politicizing European integration. That's where it starts, you know. It enters the elite discussion about what the good and the bad that the EU does, but mostly when it has to do with, you know, liberalization or difficult economic policies, they blame it on the EU. You see this kind of, but it enters the politics in a way that it was completely apolitical in the first decades. And I think it's this turning point, at least at the elite, that we can in a way discovered through the archives and public debates and parliamentary debates, where you see this change, at least, on how the EEC is presented in terms of membership or, you know, development. So I think that is quite of interesting adding, as you said, to why 70s and 80s become two more important than Maastricht, actually, and definitely more important than the first decades of European integration.
Can I return to the second question that Mary raised, namely that of the gaps, because I think that's also quite an important one. I think this is a book that, in a sense, has the huge merit of reminding us what we don't know, as well as reminding us what we do know. So Kieran has already mentioned the almost total lack of very convincing data on the economic effects of the early European community. So what's interesting is that Europe's political elite was by and large convinced that it was good for them. They were taking the medicine and they believed that they were getting better. But again, because this was within the context of a period of global economic prosperity where there were many other factors that were contributing to Europe's then booming economy, actually trying to work out what part of this was attributable to the EEC as it then was and what was attributable to more general factors is very, very hard to do. Likewise, I think there were people who began to sort of cast doubts about the beneficial effects of European integration during the 1970s. Or I think one of the strongest arguments that Kieran makes is that it's actually probably precisely at that moment that European integration, in a sense, most demonstrably helps, if only by stopping a major slide back into protectionism in the way that the previous economic recessions might have caused. So I think sort of that something as basic as, is this really helping us economically? The answer is we just don't know. We can guess, we can say that individual actors believed so, we can say that others contradicted them, but it's very, very difficult, and I'm not enough of an economic specialist to be able to make these calculations myself, but we need some sort of heavy-duty economic historians to weigh in and say this did contribute and this didn't contribute and this made a difference and this didn't and this harmed and this hindered. But at the moment, we just don't know.
Can I briefly react to two points that were made in the discussion so far? Again, Irene, I think, has a very good point in talking and bringing in also Southern European countries. And at least what I'm trying to do in the book is also to move beyond the large member states only. And I think that there is a lot to be gained in also looking not only at the Benelux countries as smaller member states from the first stages also already of European integration, but for instance, also at places such as Iceland, again, a country that left the integration process in the 1980s, Algeria, again, another place that is normally marginalized in the history of integration, but also, as Irene very much argued, these Mediterranean countries that were part of the enlargement runs of the 1980s, where my argument is that a lot of what the EU then claims as itself as being a community of values is not something that came from within, but that was also basically projected on them and that were credentials that were coming from these Mediterranean countries. So in that sense, we really need these other dimensions going beyond the if you will, slightly more conventional Franco-German focus in some of the literature to really see the complexity and the dynamics. And the argument would also be that, again, also these actors that sometimes are being framed as slightly more marginal matter an awful lot. And the second point to Piers, again, I would fully agree. And again, I was shocked, I should say, when I started to look into the economic literature, also by economic historians, how little there was. And again, also shocked against the backdrop that the European communities throughout its history has been fantastic at creating papers and reports and almost anything you can possibly think of, but not on this very issue, because I also saw in some of the documents a certain reluctance to touch upon it, because they also felt that the arguments tended to work better without more robust analytical focus on these questions. And again, politicians insinuating, thinking, arguing that this might be beneficial, then really going down to the figures. And again, some things might still be possible for economic historians, as somebody's also trying to approach this from a cultural history perspective. That itself is already something I find highly fascinating, this lack of knowledge and lack of interest also by people, if you will, that the people themselves were not more interesting and probing the integration process more as to what it actually delivered. So that is also one of the puzzles that for me was always hidden in this process, that people weren't really taking more interest in one of the core legitimizing factors of the whole process.
Eleni, did you want to come in on this at all about?
I mean, well, I think what Kieran's a great contribution, because coming having studied the Mediterranean enlargement as detailed as possible, I think what was amazingly interesting is that as Kieran sets out, and it's not just the Mediterranean, it's about how the EC relations with third countries really defined the identity and the institutional ethos that just didn't exist or they didn't care to have until that point. But also what is intriguing is that the EC became quite good in instructing the others what to do to get in, but had no mechanism to what to do when they've actually entered. And that is the huge problem and one of the major kind of problems that the EU is facing right now. They have a great mechanism, they have institutionalized it even informally, you know, going to the Copenhagen criteria and moving on, how to define what they stand for and how to protect it. But there's almost zero mechanism or ways of how to make that work when a country has actually become a member state and does not conform anymore to what are the norms, values, or, you know, legal aspects. And I think this kind of disconnect is so interesting to see how and when it went wrong. That at least as historians, we still don't know. We are only grasping how it started, but we don't know why it ended the way it did.
Piers, did you want to come in again?
Well, just to say that I agree with this emphasis on sort of outside pressures playing a major role from the very beginning of the European integration process. So this is, and again, I think this is very much to sort of applaud Kieran's method of looking at so many actors and trying to look at these outside forces. You can't explain what happens simply by looking at decision makers in Brussels, in Bonn, as it was in Paris. Yes, of course, they contributed to some of the developments, but a lot of the time they were reacting to pressures, they were reacting to expectations, they were reacting to crises that were reaching them from outside, and therefore their ability to sort of plot a course was it was much more akin to firefighting and coping with immediate problems than it was having some grand strategic vision. Just sort of one of the interesting things I take away from this is that sort of I was talking earlier about how there is a level of ambition in the institutions from the outset. Yes, there is a level of ambition, but it's terribly vague. There's a kind of possibly an end destination dimly in mind, but the path there is utterly unmapped out. Sort of the treaty maps you out as far as the timing of a few tariff reductions, and that's about it. So the rest of the way is a matter of kind of improvisation and making it up as you go along. And in trying to understand how the EU or the EC as it was has made it up as it goes along. Outside pressures have been fundamentally important, and probably none more so than enlargement. I think the role of enlargement as a process that has not just simply shaped the countries that have joined, but has shaped the union or community that they have been joining, is absolutely fundamental. Irini shows it in her book, Kieran demonstrates it in his, and there's a lot of other literature on that point.
Let me turn in a slightly different direction. As Kieran noted, his book covers the four Cold War decades, but the real core of his argument is about the 1970s and the 1980s, in which he sees the EC undergoing some fundamental transformations, taking on a whole new importance. Now, these decades are, at least among historians on my side of the Atlantic, very much a preoccupation, and it's usually narrated in a quite simplistic way of the rise of the market, the decline of the state, the emergence uncontested of neoliberalism, and the triumph of globalization over the national, but also the regional, the sidelining of any international organizations except the IMF and World Bank. So in what ways does the history of the EC in these decades and the emergence of the EU really complicate and challenge this kind of dominant narrative of, you know, the 70s, 80s as a key decade of transformation?
Shall I have a first stab at it? I think this is definitely, so big a question. I'm sure we all have a contribution to make on this. I think it complicates it a lot. I just don't think that model really maps onto the EC experience at all. This is a period where the discomforts of globalization, and in fact, a lot of the challenges that we now face at the moment, are very starkly apparent. This is a period of economic downturn. This is a period of geopolitical instability. This is a period where environmental concerns and resource shortages are moving very much to the center of the political agenda. So there's a lot of familiar territory there, and the challenge of popular discontent, etc. So there's a lot that we can see that parallels our own era. But I don't really see the EU fitting into this pattern of the response to these challenges that you've just described. For start, it's clearly not a period which is about the defeat of regionalism. It's a period which in many ways will end with the most constructive period of integration there is, namely the late 1980s, early 1990s. Now, getting there was hard. The 70s were difficult to live through, were a period of as many frustrations as they were successes. But nevertheless, even the 70s are a period where Europe is trying to do a lot regionally. Even if, like a toddler taking its first steps, it tends to fall flat on its face rather more often than it sort of succeeds in sprinting away. But nevertheless, it's trying. And so the answers are not global answers. They're not just market answers. They are genuinely regional answers, albeit contested regional answers, with different politicians wanting a very interventionist policy, others favouring a somewhat more laissez-faire approach, market-driven. So there are lots of different answers, as somebody like Laurent Valuzet has very eloquently set out, the different European visions, but they are in a sense all fairly European visions. So I just don't think it fits, I don't think Europe fits with this kind of death of regionalism approach.
Before anyone else chimes in, let me just say, if any of the audience wants to ask a question, you can either put the question in chat or you can raise your hand under the participants thing, and then we can call on you. Kieran, did you want to jump in?
Happy to, yeah, very much so. Again, I fully agree with Piers, and this is also an argument that the book tries to make, and maybe to also contextualize a little bit with the state of the art. Again, also here, I'd like to emphasize that my book is really building on recent research by many others. Again, there is an older literature, also from political science, that has argued that the 1970s was a dark period, as one pair of authors has once argued in the early 1990s. dark ages of European integration, where it was basically all about crisis, this ugly term of eurosclerosis basically summarizing developments. And again, many researchers over the past 10, 15 years from history, but also a little bit from other fields, have tried to qualify this image and really shown that, as Piers argued, there was a toddler maybe stumbling and falling down from time to time, but ultimately also with new initiatives, often informally, as Irene was already mentioning before, being built up, which ultimately then were also channeled into the more official process with the Single European Act of 1987, with the Maastricht Treaty and later treaties. So in that sense, without that kind of period of trial and error of bricolage, as one would probably say in French, of again informal little initiatives, one would not have arrived at the other and much deeper forms of integration that one then sees from the mid-1980s onwards. So in that sense, I think the global story that you summarized for us, Molly, that you find in some of the literature does not really work particularly well for this story here. And there is a lot of new research that has actually basically provided the grounds for making this case that also my book then advances on the various issues. Still, having said that, I have to say that I myself was surprised also writing one chapter after the other, how much the 1970s and 80s were actually a period where across these various policy dimensions, there was such a fundamental change, again, from ambition, if you go back to that term, to really becoming a much more important institutional player that started to impact people's lives. Though, and that is the last point here, I think most people were quite unaware of that. And that also explains some of the backlash and the crisis and the conflicts since the 1990s that you had from the 70s onwards, a hidden form of transformation that gained momentum from the mid-1980s onwards, culminated in the Maastricht Treaty, without many people being aware of that, because these processes were very much crisis, but also elite-driven. And hence also this history is important, crucially important to understand the more recent problems and challenges to European integration that we also see with Brexit and other more recent phenomena.
Nainé, do you want to jump in on this one?
I mean, I couldn't agree more with what Kieran said. I think what is interesting is that you see this kind of transformation taking place, but it's not evident. It takes a while to really understand the impact of the measures that are taking place to respond to this kind of global development, either the breakdown of the Bretton Woods and, you know, the initiation of the EMS and all these different kind of enlarging the European Union, trying to deepen it at the same time. But I think what is interesting is that even unknowingly, the EEC, because it's part of this global web, kind of adapts and, in a way, it's influenced by developments. If you look at the rise of human rights, even the EEC, which doesn't really seem to have it on the agenda or any blueprint in getting interested in that kind of aspect, suddenly, you know, adapts to that language that becomes, you know, the universal language of the 1970s much more. And that's just one of examples. And the same goes with the, you know, what I found interesting with Kieran, he said that we shouldn't really try to fit the EEC in one specific economic model, because in contrast to this, you know, rise of liberalism and neoliberalism that seems to be the agenda in the 1970s, the EEC still struggles to find its place. Some policies are still highly protective, like the CEP. Some have redistributive attributes, like the regional policy is not that successful, but it sets out in the 70s and the 80s. And at the same time, of course, it's market oriented in the monetary policy. So I think what is interesting is this complexity. There's no one size fits all really to explain what's happening in responding to these different crises. They seem to adapt a little bit more Europe on something that is convenient and withdraw on other aspects that seem that the nation state will become more important. So they don't have, I think that idea of a lack of a master plan is so evident in the 1970s, and I think that's why it becomes more successful. The lack of ambition suddenly makes them much more realistic on what they can do and be more hands-on.
Can I just sort of come in very briefly on something Irene has just said, because it does strike me that this is one of the challenges, though, of studying the EC of the EU as it becomes, is precisely the way in which it's in a sense, it's not philosophically or economically pure in anything that it does. It's a structure of compromise. Whether it's a compromise between 27 or a compromise between 6, it's always been about sort of slightly messy intermediary solutions. And from an analyst point of view, that's deeply frustrating. We all want to try and put it in a box. We want to say it's neoliberal. We want to say it's protectionist, or we want to say it is yes, and it isn't yes. Both answers are correct. And that's a messy reality, which I think experts struggle with, but also I think sometimes public opinion struggles with. If you're in a kind of very positive view, I suppose you can say there's something in there for everybody, but more often than not, there's actually something there in there for everybody to complain about. and so this messiness actually becomes a problem in terms of its public appeal.
Okay, I see we have one question in the chat from P.A. Brault, who asks, how long do you think Euroscepticism has been around?
If I can start answering this question, again, this is a great question. I recently gave a paper in Hamburg on this very point. And to be honest with you, I'm not a particular fan of the term Euroscepticism. Why so? Because I think it has a lot of normative implications, because it raises the implicit question of what then Europe is and what then from where Euroscepticism really starts. And there is a tendency, particularly in the older literature, to say that anything that is not geared towards the United States of Europe is basically Eurosceptic. What we see is that you often have very conflicting views of what the project actually is, as Piers was just saying, because there were, in fact, so many different dimensions all happening at the same time, but also with regard to what direction the project should actually be developing into. So in that sense, it's difficult to really say what kind of policy direction you would want to call Eurosceptic and what you don't. So in that sense, I personally like the term of, again, those who are against the project as is, because it's more precise, I think, in comparison to your skepticism. And what I'm working with in the book is really to see how Europeans were again reacting and engaging with that Europe of the ECEU as is. And there the argument is that there was much more reluctance and ignorance and lack of support than we have thought so far. Again, Euroscepticism is often seen as a project and a phenomenon of the post-Maastricht period since the 1990s. And again, I don't particularly like the term, but I would argue that some of the arguments that have been made tend to ignore some of the political conservative right, some of the communist left of the early post-war periods that were not particularly in favor of this process for various reasons. Sometimes thinking it was simply the wrong kind of Europe without not wanting a kind of European solution. From the fascist right to over on to the communist left, there were ideas of creating a different kind of Europe to the one that then was created. And hence, again, the complication of talking about Europe. So the point that Piers was making earlier about there being, again, a big platform of different ideas and not one philosophically consistent project against which you then could compare other political positions also complicates any kind of answer to the great question that you've asked.
Oops, we seem to have one more question in the chat. Let me, from Tommaso Milani, he said, the book makes a compelling argument about the role of the Cold War in shaping European integration, but because of the decision not to tackle the post-Maastricht period, does not delve too much into the long-term consequences of the end of the Cold War on Project Europe. Personally, he notes, I doubt that there was entirely that they were entirely positive, but I would be glad to hear from you. And he thanks you.
Great. Tommaso, again, thanks for joining tonight. Nice to see many familiar names and faces. Again, well, this point has been made before, that the book ends before the story gets interesting, if you will, and that there should be a sequel, a part two. Honestly, what I'm doing at the moment when I'm not talking on Zoom with people about teaching issues or again about existing projects is also trying to write something that takes this further into the 1990s. Now, on the Cold War dimension, I have to argue and to underline that I'm also very much in depth to what Piers has written about the nexus and the link and disconnect between European integration and the Cold War. Again, I think Piers is one of those scholars who's really done most to clarify this link. And I would argue that, again, the Cold War is fundamentally important, And that, however, particularly these developments since the 1970s are the main reason why European integration could develop so much further in the post-Cold War period than it had already then. So to put it into a counterfactual, had the Cold War ended in 1970, it would have been quite unlikely that this community as it then existed would have turned into such an important forum. It took these last 20 years of the Cold War to basically also let it move out beyond the Cold War framework and that cocoon within which it had developed it. A metaphor that Piers has already used before, to then also turn it into such a relevant institutional forum for post-Cold War developments. Again, southern enlargement would be one of the key dimensions, I would argue, whereby, again, there was an increasing idea that this could be a forum to create peace and stability for post-dictatorial societies. Once you have that success story being told to you in the 1980s, and comes the end of the Cold War, well, you'll probably be more inclined to think that this is also the right forum than for kind of reshaping and rethinking a post-communist Europe. So in that sense, again, the second half of the post-Cold War, I think, is crucial to understand what then happens in the next period, the post-Cold War period. And that is maybe the shortest answer I can give you to how I see that link.
Can I add something as well? I think what is interesting with what Kieran said, and you mentioned it in the epilogue, which I found so refreshing to see, is that one of the legacies of the Cold War and of this kind of over-politicized environment of the post-war period is that, you know, there is an overarching political objective. Political matters trumps economic all the time, it seems. And that is a bad legacy to have when we see in post-92. There seems to be a sense of, especially, you know, when it's kind of, there's a question of systemic import that comes in. And I think you see that kind of a difference that kind of the Cold War creates in the minds of the elite that this is a success story, you know, for political arguments, we have to move forward, whereas economic argumentation is there and it's not taken for granted just because of the political. And just the second point is before I give the floor to Piers, I think with your skepticism, I think is right, because Catherine De Vries has written this amazing book rejecting this monodimensional definition we give to Euroscepticism, and had this kind of different data sets, which I think historians should start using much more in understanding, you know, what Europe means and what means rejecting or having a completely different idea about what you expect from European integration. I think Kieran is making this kind of first substantive step in incorporating that kind of literature from political scientists in our own understanding of how, you know, this kind of discontent is brewing with its great manifestation happening now.
It's probably unfair to ask historians to speculate about the future, but I'm going to do it nonetheless. If the EU in its current form and with the importance it has was a product of the crises and challenges of the 70s and 80s, do you think the EU is going to maintain its current importance, way of operating and setting policy, its institutions in the face of this whole series of crises over the last decade, from the Great Recession through the migration crises, the extreme right turn of Hungary and Poland, Brexit, and now the pandemic with its enormous health and economic consequences?
So am I the first victim of this question? I think historians are horribly bad at predicting the future. So all I'm saying is going to be probably wrong only because I'm saying it probably. But I think what history shows is that this project has become surprisingly resilient. Again, what Piers has said before is that it is a mess, if you will. It's a hodgepodge of different ideas, of policies that come from all kinds of corners and directions. But I think also it has become the sum of the compromises between different ideas and policies. And that has also made it more resilient because, again, there is also something in for everybody, or most people, one should think. I would argue that probably there is quite high a likelihood that it will continue along these lines. And also the second phase of reacting to Corona could be seen in that lens, because again, in the beginning, the EU looked as if it wasn't existent anymore. But with the reconstruction and rescue package, again, it is entering a completely new field, which future generations of historians might see as a new starting point in many ways of policy creation at a EU level that we've never seen before. The only reason why I'd see that the EU could enter a real crisis is really for two reasons. Either it could be if the euro would really come under fundamental pressure from a big member state, or if there was, and that hasn't really happened so far, accumulation of various crises. So what I think we've also seen over the past 10 years is various crises, but so far the EU has been remarkably successful at isolating one crisis from the other, at keeping them separate and dealing with them independently, one after the other, again, immigration, Brexit, Grexit, what have you not. And again, if as long as those mechanisms continue to be successful of creating firewalls between the various issues, the EU will probably continue to exist and probably develop further.
Piers, do you want to come in?
I think I would agree with much of that. I think I would add sort of two thoughts. I think the lesson that one takes both from looking at the longer history that Kieran has written about and all of us have sort of thrown in our opinions about, but also look at the more recent past 10 years or so with the succession of crises. The one thing that does come out very, very clearly is, in a sense, the desire for most of those involved in the system at the sort of political level to keep the show on the road. The compromises they arrive at, the mechanisms they devise, the solutions they find are, as I said before, often messy, untidy, they don't fit neatly into categories and are frustrating to analyse and frustrating to understand. But I think of the volition to keep the show on the road, that there can be no doubt. I think the biggest challenge, in a sense, is communicating that to the popular level. Because I think it's almost axiomatic amongst most of Europe's leaders that this is something we want to continue. But as the example of my own country show, if you lose popular support and you can't then continue in this process. And I think that is a challenge that Europe does face. And I think one of the big things that it has to do better in the future is explaining its purpose and convincing the general public, rather than, in a sense, taking for granted their assent, or at least taking for granted that their dissent can be contained and prevented from overwhelming the system. So that, for me, is the biggest danger. But I think the underlying desire to press on, not necessarily to go much further, but just simply to continue what we have, is I think, fairly evident.
Lenny? I agree completely with both takes. And what I would just add is that I think even if it doesn't, if we follow a process of disintegration, that many political scientists are writing about, we have an avalanche of literature just on that theme, just to balance out the historians of European integration. I think what is happening is that even politicians, but also scholars who are studying these events, to just accept that, you know, disintegration can take on various forms, if they are horizontal or vertical or sectoral. That doesn't mean the end of the project. It means taking a step back when it's needed in different sections. I think it very much adds to what Kieran was saying about how, you know, you're trying to control these different crises by creating walls around them. And I think that's what I think is the big change. And also, one of the biggest arguments that Kieran makes, and I didn't mention that before, is that with Brexit, if you take the examples of Greenland and other countries, you know, exiting or disintegrating does not mean restoring full sovereignty. We don't know how this is going to play out. That's the reality. So even if we take a step back and we think it's a disaster, which, you know, most of us are in a doom and gloom of what is going to happen, we still don't know how it's going to play out, because it's impossible to restore it in such a globalized, interconnected world. And I think this is where the hopes are resting, on how you're going to navigate that by bringing the public on board as well, which is the big challenge that Piers was talking about.
Okay, I think we have come to the end of our time. I want to thank all of our participants, and particularly Kieran, for writing this very important book. If you haven't read it yet, you should. Get hold of it immediately. You will find it enormously interesting, provocative, and very readable. As I said to Kieran, who thought anyone could make writing the history of European integration so gripping? And he does. So thank you all, and thank the audience for coming.